In this episode of the Digital Engagement Forecast, we're going to be interviewing Alex Herter at the dukeandtheduck.com. Alex is joining us to talk a little bit about his creative strategy and also the history of Duke and the Duck and how he and his partner co-founded it and helped. How long were they around?
I don't know. They've been around maybe a half dozen years. It's been impressive how they've grown over the past couple of years. Maybe not in terms of size, but in terms of the quality of their product. I've been, watching their videos as they come out. They're really experts in storytelling, and they do that usually in the form of, short animations. But their stuff is getting really, really pretty slick, and I think you'll learn a lot from this episode, which, of course, is brought to you by
Charity Engine. If your CRM is driving you to drink, give Charity Engine a call.
And that's charityengine.net. Now, here's our conversation with Alex.
So you guys have been in business since 2009.
Yeah.
And you've just sort of slowly grown every year, adding a person, basically? Or
No. We basically started as two friends not wanting to have real jobs.
Was about when I met you, actually, wasn't it? Right about, was that about five years ago, maybe?
I think it was maybe more like 2.5 or 3 years.
Okay.
It was at the end of that period of let's just hang out and play video games. It was at the start of the period of like we should probably have like
we should
do
maybe
real work.
Start paying taxes.
Yeah, well, I mean, we just didn't make enough money to really pay taxes.
Yeah. Yeah, I said that. Turns out you still have
to
pay taxes.
Yeah, we did. We did. Although I think we did forget 1 year, so the next year was more. I was doing marketing for this healthcare technology startup, and I hired Dave, my college roommate, to make videos for our product. And people liked them, so we started doing them on the side. And then the company I was working for took a turn towards domestic work, like U.S. Their board basically wanted an exit. Mm-hmm. And because we were a health technology firm focused on the developing world, which, of course, is never going to get an exit. And so they wanted to pivot domestically, and I didn't really want to do that. And so there was a successful side gig, and so I quit. And I did that. And then we worked together.
So did you guys start actually just doing it on top of your, on weekends and evenings?
Yeah.
Like making
videos
and stuff?
Yeah. Well, mostly him making videos and me telling him to make videos, but yeah.
But you found people to pay for the videos.
Yes. Yeah, that has always been my unique strength.
And what's the Duke and the Duck? Who's the Duke and who's the Duck?
You
get that question every time you
meet
someone.
We do. So there are a couple of good answers to that. The answer that I give most often is that we're big believers in the power of stories to educate, inspire, entertain. And this sounds like a fable or a fairy tale, which, of course, is one of the oldest forms of storytelling. So mm-hmm. we have that in our name.
Is there a Duke and the Duck fable that you've come up with?
We've started many, many, many times, but we've never actually gotten there. Yeah. We probably should.
Well, that sounds like when we're, we always want to do like a video for the homepage of our website that like tells what we do. And I would say we've probably done 10 of them mm-hmm. and finished one, and it sucks. I don't know. When you get into you get that deep into describing yourself, it just...
Well, sometimes it's hard to be your own cheerleader, right?
No, you need to hire someone else to write the story of the Duke and the Duck.
Yeah, that doesn't have that investment, that has a little bit of emotional detachment, which can actually be a good thing when you're trying to tell your own story.
Yeah, I totally agree. We finally did. We buckled and gave up our free WordPress site that we were using for many years that was just garbage, and we hired a design firm in our co-working space to redo our branding and to redo our website.
So they came up with the logo?
Yeah.
Love your logo.
Isn't it cool?
What did you think when you first saw it?
I thought it was perfect. I have actually always hated our company name because despite my flaming social democrat liberalness, I feel like I'm pretty conservative at heart. You know, when I name a warrior character in a video game or something, I go with like Lothar or something really safe. So anytime I like make a choice, I usually go with a safe option. And so the name has always felt kind of weird and out there and a little more than I'm comfortable with. But when these guys, Friendly Design...
So you can't look someone in the eye and tell them it's all about fables and storytelling and keep a straight face and feel confident what you're saying.
It's about half the time. About half the time I can do it. About half the time I then say sort of the origin story of the name, which is all of those things are true, but really my wife came up with the name. And it was because my partner's name is Duke Ellington, or not Duke Ellington, Dave Ellington. And so the Duke comes with that. And in video games, again, I don't know why video game names are coming up so much, but his name is Sir Duke in a lot of games. So the Duke made sense. And then, of course, the duck is sort of an alliterative thing there. And it's...
So you got stuck with
the brand sort of got stuck.
You got kind of screwed up.
So you're the duck.
Yeah. Yeah, which is weird because I'm definitely the serious one and he's definitely the silly one, but
should have been the duck and the fucking warrior or something.
Mm-hmm.
The duck and the king.
I like Duke and the duck. I feel like you own that SEO, though.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a lot of Duke and duck anything.
You would be surprised. There are two other video firms with duck in the name. So there's...
But not Duke.
No. That's
not
true.
Not American companies with the word Duke.
Yeah.
That's true. Although,
this is like an old dog.
Right. If you just Google Duke Duck or Duke and the Duck, you'll get a lot of Duke University rubber duckies.
But you have D&D, which is storytelling.
Right. What's the firm up in New York? Automatic Duck?
There's the Big Duck, and they're in Brooklyn. They're a comms firm. They specialize in nonprofit work. And then there's another one called Big Yellow Duck. I think they're in Columbus.
Just Big Duck?
No, that's in New York.
Yeah.
And then there's Yellow Duck or Big Yellow Duck or something. They're in Ohio, I think. But they do explainer animations. I mean, they're straight up the same as we are. And it is hilarious. And their marketing is amazing. I look up to them a lot. I think our video work is on par or better, but the way they talk about themselves is impressive.
So we actually got on point here after talking about books and technology for a long time. what you guys do is you guys do explainer videos. Is that summing it up succinctly?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's 85% of what we do. It's certainly our core competence. I mean, in 6 years, we've done like 140 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we do that. We also do live action commercials, sort of mini documentary style stuff. We've done some digital and things like that, but we don't want to.
So
we
it's,
don't like
it's
it.
Mostly animation, but you do live action stuff. Like
we do.
Videography and production.
Talking heads, commercials, that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Is that all in-house or are you hiring out for that stuff?
We have never done one where we haven't brought at least one other person in.
Yeah.
Usually it's production coordination, strategy, and messaging in-house, and we'll hire a DP because we just don't have someone in staff who's good enough to trust with that.
And your co-working space, is that a nice... Obviously, it's a good place to tap into people to do logos for you. Do you find all kinds of help there, like who's got an accountant that I can get a phone number for?
There's a lot of sharing of that sort of thing. Experience. I mean, a lot of people have a similar sort of experience, right? They're running a small team. They have the same issues. You know, how do I do payroll? Mm-hmm.
And you guys,
what is taxes?
You guys get work out of that too? Like, are you doing videos for these guys? Or
very little. I mean, we're
too expensive.
We're expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not expensive in that we're not, you know, Buck or one of these really great international production firms that's going to put 10 people in. 10 award-winning, amazing people on a project. Yeah. You know, we're going to have one or two people.
You're going to charge $100,000 for a 30-second animation.
Right, so we're not at $150,000, but we are at $15,000. And so for people who think that $15,000 is a lot, obviously that doesn't work. And for small firms, that is a lot. And so usually what we'll do is say, well, you know, here are some freelancers that we've worked with and we like, and good luck.
So how do people come to you? Like, what's the reason most often that your phone rings and someone says, hey, I need a video?
I mean, I think the biggest problem that we solve is that people have a story that they're trying to tell. They have a product they want to promote. They have a because we're in DC, they have a public policy solution that they're having trouble getting people to understand. And our Medium, the short explainer video, is a really easy way to sort of rapidly close that knowledge gap. You're not going to get 100%, but it's the sort of 80-20 rule. If you, in 2 minutes, can get you 80% of the way there, that's awesome. And so I think that's the most common problem that we solve.
And is that because the visual medium is just, you can pack so much more information into whatever seconds of attention that you can pry away from somebody?
I think it's actually even more of a multiplicative effect. I think that if you know, there's this classic...
logarithmic, is what you're saying.
Right. you're hearing it and you're seeing it. So, for example, hey, what's the structure of an atom? Well, I can write a paragraph describing it, or I can show a static picture. But isn't it better to say, okay, so here's an atom. It forms all material on Earth. Now let's go in the atom. Oh, in the center, there's a nucleus, and in it is this and this. And if you can explode it and you can actually show people what you're talking about while you're talking about it, there's no better medium except perhaps having an expert right in front of you that you can ask questions of.
Yeah.
But that obviously is very expensive and a whole different business model.
What channel are you primarily producing for? Are you getting requests for, are these online videos? Are they going to be on TV? Are they multi-channel?
They're increasingly becoming more multi-channel as we're sort of moving more up market. But online is 95%. We've done some standard TV commercials. We've done a fair amount of videos for conferences. I'd say it's, if you look at our body of work, it's 90% for online audience. You know, these numbers are going to overlap. 15% of, you know, conferences, and then maybe 5% of TV, or we did an ad for Curb, which is a taxi ordering company, and they're in the back, the little screens in the taxis, and in cinema screens. So that was weird. So it was like cinema ads and the back of taxis, or the backseat of taxis. And then we're starting to do some more PSA work.
I look at those taxi ads, and they all are pretty low budget.
But
you see them over and over again. I wonder if that's a good value for dollar for.
I feel like it's got to be the same as like toilet advertising. Nobody wants it.
Yeah, but I sit there like I'm thinking of the one, the D.C. statehood one with, who's that, like, civil rights guy? I've seen it 100 times, and he's, like, looking off to the side of the camera because they couldn't afford a telephone.
Oh, and you can see him reading? Yeah, where his eyes are scanning. Paper,
you know, and it's just, you could tell it cost $3,000 to make.
Do you think it's cheap to advertise in the back of a taxi?
Since
everybody's
you
going
just
to Uber,
the same things. Over
I have no idea, but I definitely know who to talk to.
You see Jimmy Kimmel and Jeopardy ads, and then you see like the same three commercials over and over again.
We should advertise for taxi ads. Mm-hmm. So we should have this whole side gig. Just go after that, dominate that market.
Yeah. Well,
if you're riding in taxis about a year ago, you would have seen our ads for Curb.
Well, does anybody ever come to you and say, hey, we've already thought about our marketing and distribution strategy, and we know who our target audience is, and so here's our messaging, here's how we're going to get to those people and hand you that? Has that ever happened?
Yeah. Yeah, it has. I'm trying very hard to think of... It happened recently, and I was just so impressed. Usually it's for when it's really specific. So 3 or 4 years ago, we did a project for a team at Intel, a team of like 20 people whose funding had run out and they needed board approval in order to continue. So they knew exactly what they wanted to say. They knew exactly who they were talking to, the board at Intel.
So this is the last bit of funding they had.
The last part of money they had was to make a promo video for their product so the board would give them more money.
That's brilliant.
I don't think it worked, but but they knew what they wanted. But it's rare. It's rare.
I'll tell you how we... It's usually somebody wants a video.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, sometimes I convince people that they should tell their message with the video. Mm-hmm. But generally it's like somebody, the president, the director of communications, wants to do a video.
Mm-hmm.
But they really haven't thought beyond that. I mean, maybe they know what they want to say, obviously, but they don't know how to say it. They don't know who they're saying it to. So they call you, and then what's that first meeting like?
Yeah, so one of the things that I try to get at pretty quickly is whether indeed they do want a video, or whether they need a video. So I think a lot of times people decide, oh yeah, I need a video, and you show up, and they actually need an app, they actually need a social strategy, they actually need something else. So a lot of times that first meeting is in part convincing them they don't need a video.
I just did that the other day with my wife. I got off the phone, my wife's like, did you just convince that woman not to hire you? I was like, yeah, I think I did.
But I think that's great, because it's a really good investment for the future.
You earned trust, and it would have been a shitty video.
Exactly, because it didn't actually solve their problem. Because ultimately, I want to be judged by whether we solved their problem, not whether we created a cool video. And if a video wasn't going to solve their problem, you know, their website is bad, a video won't help that. They should probably put the money that they would spend in, you know, hiring someone to do a cheap website or something.
If that happens again, call us.
Yes.
Send them us. Well, that's good. I mean, establishing that, you know, when I worked on the Hill, my first job, I was a legislative assistant, and I had this like lobbyist, you know, back then they could like take you out to dinner. He took me to Morton's, I think. And he's like, and I sort of was like, I had this idea that lobbyists are these horrible people. All they're doing is like pushing their case on you. But really what they're doing is they're trying to establish a relationship with you of trust, so that when the issue comes up, you call them and you can say, you know, what's going on here? Give me both sides. Give me your side and give me the other side, so that when my boss asks me, I can look good. And then we've got a relationship, and then I'm going to feel indebted to you. And so I think, you know, that was like a total eye-opener, which is like you approach it not from a business development standpoint, but from just a relationship standpoint. Like, you know, give people good advice.
Yeah, business development is, I think that gets glossed over a lot, that it is relationship building. Especially if you don't have to worry about the short term. It's nice to actually be able to tell somebody, no, here's what you really need, and let me introduce you to my friend. Mm-hmm. Because needs change, and maybe they really do have a video project. Yeah, but
it is just a luxury to be able to say no.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, although the investment there is actually in, obviously, the client who doesn't need a video, it turns out, but also the person you've referred that client to. Mm-hmm. You've now got two people who are thankful.
And there's actually a risk to start really pushing a project on somebody who, in the end, is going to waste a lot of your time and may not ever even sign a contract.
Yeah.
Or they do, and then they're that client that bails halfway and doesn't pay you, and you get only a portion of it. Like, that really happens.
Yeah, it does.
And you've been around, though, for a few years. What are some of those red flags when you're, you know, they're kind of wishy-washy in that meeting, or you're trying to, maybe you're thinking in the back of your head, this isn't a good project for you, but they keep insisting they are. What are some of the things, if somebody says, hey, we need a video, what are some things that they should be asking themselves to see, do I really need a video?
I'm going to answer the question I thought you were going to ask first.
That's a better question.
Which is sort of the red flags of maybe this won't work out.
Yeah.
And the big one is, this is a great portfolio piece, which I'm sure you've heard many times, or this is a small budget, but there's going to be a lot more later. Like, it'll be a series.
Portfolio piece beats pro bono.
Right, exactly. and in part also size. So we've had, in 6 years, we haven't had that many disasters. We've only had three clients never pay. And we've probably only had half a dozen horrible experiences, which is great. Sort of averaging one a year-ish. Almost all of them were clients that were stretching to pay us. That's like, oh yeah, 20 grand. And they go, oh, that's tough. You know, anyone who's, you say that and they're like, oh yeah, great. Or one of our current clients, CIT, which is a big financial services firm in New York. When I set our pricing, she laughed at me on the phone. For those people, it's fine. Because the issue is the stress that gets added to the situation. So I think that those are the big indicators that this may not go well.
Yeah. Well, people who feel like they're giving you, you know, as so much of their resources also become very demanding.
Or they genuinely are, right? It could be 20% of their communication budget or 50% of their communication budget.
I mean, it's like, well, but that's the point. It's like, well, to them, it's a big deal. Right. And they then become much more hands-on, which sometimes is not always the best thing for a client to do, as opposed to just trusting you to make the right decision when they give you the strategy.
Right.
But sticking away from like advice for other video firms and focusing on what the client may actually like, which I have a hard time sometimes sympathizing mm-hmm. with. So Brian's second question, which was, what are some reasons? What was your question? What are some reasons?
Well, what should, if somebody says, I think we need a video. Mm-hmm. Great. What are, I guess, some internal questions that they could ask or bring up before approaching a firm that really makes it a better experience or results in them going, oh, no, that was a horrible idea?
Okay, so the biggest thing that I would say is your marketing work, your marketing campaign, whether it's a single campaign or your core marketing strategy, needs to be a series of stepping stones. A video will not solve your problem. So if all you're planning on doing is making a video, it may not be a good experience because people will watch the video and then have watched a video, mm-hmm. Which is probably not your goal. Your goal was to get them to donate, sign a petition, call a member of Congress, buy a product, whatever. And the thing is that a video alone will almost never, in fact, never get you to do that alone. And so
not even if they say, we just want to, it's a public awareness campaign. So we just want to, like, let people out there kind of know this is happening.
I mean, if they genuinely think that that's all that matters. So we do a lot of work at the Pew Charitable Trust, and they don't really worry about funding all that much. They don't worry about getting people to sign petitions. In fact, I think to some degree they're sort of hesitant of making too many waves. And really they're just putting out good research, good public policy information, and they really just want people to understand it well. Mm. So for them, a view is the goal. But I think they're unusual. I think most people are spending money on communication in order to get people to do something. And so one of my sort of red flags is if they haven't thought through the journey. You know, okay, who's going to watch it? How are they going to watch it? Where is it? Is it on Facebook? Is it on Twitter? Is it on YouTube? How did they get there? There's this myth that somehow you put something on YouTube and someone will watch it. I don't understand.
Or just the internet.
Right. You just put it on the internet and people will watch it.
It's there for everything.
You know, if they don't have a plan for like, okay, it's going to go out to this newsletter of 50,000 people. Great. Okay. That's a plan. That's how someone's going
to
watch it.
To see those plans?
Not to see them, but to ask. I ask people to think about them. I often ask people to pay us to help come up with that. We've gotten people to do that maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
Which I think is ridiculous because honestly, I think the plan is even more important than the content. Like, you could go cheap on the content. You could not work with us on the content, which obviously isn't in my interest to say.
Shoot something on your iPhone and just deliver the same message. And
if the story's really well thought out, because most importantly, so it's also, those are all the steps of how are you going to get to the video. But after having seen the video, what do? Do you download a white paper? Do you sign up for this thing? Do you go to this microsite? And if they don't have a sense of that, if it's just go to our website, I sort of know that it's not going to be an effective piece of collateral. And for some people, that's a big deal. And for some people, as I mentioned, views are fine. And in fact, not even many views. It's really, in so many cases, the audience that actually matters, even though no one says it, is senior management. It's, you know,
performance.
It's two people above you in the hierarchy. They see the video and they go, that was a really good video. And that was a great expense for you. Like, that's a personal win.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say that's wrong because that's fine.
That's wrong. I'll say it. it's a circle jerk. A lot of work is that, though.
Yeah.
Just trying to position yourself internally and use your budget wisely mm-hmm. and being perceived as having value. But that's not metrics driven, right?
What I'm talking about
creating value.
But what I'm talking about are cultures where that's not there is no discussion about that.
Well, that money comes from somewhere, whether it's people, whether it's taxpayers, whether it's donors, and I actually do think it's a disservice to those funding sources. It's grant funds. It's that money didn't just come out of nowhere. A lot of the organizations we overlap with are funded by those. Kind of by those revenue sources, not through, selling of some product or bigger service. But yeah, I don't know. The more I got involved with nonprofit communities, the more I became aware of the frivolous spending of money. Mm-hmm. And not to say, I know there's this big conversation internally in kind of the progressive space about, what percent of funds go to program work versus overhead, and does that really matter? And completely devoid of that, just being on the consulting side, just being in the space with folks working for nonprofits in kind of middle and senior level management, just seeing.
It's not that they're going out having expensive vacations.
It's always in the heart's in the right place.
Yeah, it's not strategic use of funds.
You talked about like not having that vision, and like those red flags for organizations can be all over the place.
Yeah.
Whether it's staffing, hiring an intern and not having a plan for that person, to we're going to completely redesign the website. And really what you're doing is you're redesigning it for your staff, not for the people visiting the site and interacting with it.
Yeah, but my issue there is that very often what we're talking about are cultures that have created certain paths for success and certain incentives. So it's very hard for me to blame someone in a system at, say, the Gates Foundation, where the culture is set up in a certain way that you succeed by doing blank. In the case of the Gates Foundation, very often it's you succeed by making management feel like you're succeeding, right? It's not necessarily about serving this constituent group, though in some cases it is.
Do you want to name any specific people at Gates?
I don't. We've actually only worked with Gates once, and it was a disaster of a project because they basically just cut it. And
was that one of your six nightmare projects that you referenced earlier?
It wasn't a nightmare project. It was very, very odd, though. And I sort of have a theory of these really rich nonprofits that when you're not required to raise money, you end up doing some very strange things. And in this situation, they rushed. They paid us like twice our normal fee to produce a video in 3 weeks. Normally it takes eight. They paid a design firm that I know, again, rushed fees. I don't know what their numbers were, but I'm sure they were high. To create what honestly was a really cool sort of education learning portal. And then I heard nothing. We delivered the product and I heard nothing. And I waited for an announcement because obviously they were in a rush, and nothing. I set like a Google alert. I do that with all our clients. So I have a Google alert for all our clients, and it didn't, nothing. And eventually a month later, I sort of reached out and said, what happened? Oh, they canned the project.
Wow.
And like in the scheme of things, Gates Foundation has a lot of money. All right, they wasted that. Fine, but it's odd. And you don't see a lot of organizations that are more beholden to fundraisers, right? I mean, Gates doesn't raise money, really, because they don't need to.
Mm-hmm. So what? getting back to the client. So let's assume that they've got a well thought out marketing strategy. What's the next step then? It's realizing the messaging, I would assume. Like, let's walk through, how we're going to tell people our story.
Yeah. I think there are two questions that I keep coming back to, and I do this in the kickoff meeting, in the prep, and then throughout production. The title.
Are you the project manager generally?
No. That's an important thing because I am not good at that. So the titles I've arbitrarily given myself are president and creative director. President to represent the sort of in charge of all the sales, and then creative director in that I ask these two questions the entire time that we're doing anything.
Who's your target audience?
And the two questions are, who are we talking to? and what do we want them to do?
How often does that change?
It doesn't change a lot, but it's amazing how quickly everyone, including clients, lose track of that. Because either
how
an artist...
How often do they say, we want to talk to seniors, and then we also want to talk to pretty much everybody.
Yeah. So right in the beginning, we do a whole big kickoff. We have like a 2-hour song and dance kickoff process. And we generate this brief. And the brief is the Bible of the project. And it has a hierarchy of audiences. So you never get the... We want to talk to 35-year-old journalists who specialize in tech. That would be awesome, but we don't get that. But we will get, you're right, female seniors in the southern states, which is a pretty specific audience. Great. And journalists. And legislators. And, well, everybody, really. But then we put those in a ranked order and constantly go back to that question. Is one of the real challenges is taste enters into things. So someone somewhere says, oh, I don't like the color green. Or an artist on our staff says, wouldn't it be cool if we could do blank? And so you need something to judge every decision by. And it is, are we going to get our audience, first question, to do the thing we want them to do, to buy the product, to invest, to whatever, with this decision? Do we make it green or do we make it purple? What will result in these two questions having a success?
So when they're reviewing character sketches and initial scripts, and they've got a committee of 5 people mm-hmm. who you're dealing with over there, and they generally listen to what everybody says, and so invariably someone doesn't like the character, the way he looks, someone doesn't like the color, someone else doesn't like the way the script is written, and you get into this routine of just rewriting and changing and watering down. And so, you know, to be effective, it's got to be sharp and focused. And the natural process for this kind of project is often to make it bland and boring.
To dull. Yeah, it dulls the edge.
So how do you fight that?
Well, two things.
By the way, this is my personal, biggest...
Your battle.
...problem. I don't know how to do it. You can argue to the point where you get them mad, mm-hmm. and you can't go any further because they're the client, and then you become so beaten down that you just finally just say, fine.
Yeah.
I'll just do that, and I'm not going to be interested in this anymore.
Yeah, and I've done that many times. Yeah. I think there are a couple things. One is having that sort of those two questions and just keep coming back and being willing to say, yes, I hear you. You don't like this, but we're talking to this person, mm-hmm. and this person needs this information in order to do this action that you agreed. Another thing is that we are militant about revisions and numbers of revisions. It doesn't sound good to hear it, but our job is not to give you your favorite video. Our job is to give you a video that will accomplish your goals within scope.
Do you have someone who is the bad cop?
Yeah.
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 Who says, I'm sorry, that's out of scope. You have to pay more for that.
And it alternates, but for the most part, it's our producer, Rick. So you mentioned project manager earlier, and he's the one who keeps the trains on time and the trains on the tracks and all other train metaphors. He's that guy.
But he can only do that because of that initial meeting you have where you set expectations, but also set priorities mm-hmm. that the client themselves say, these are our priorities, these are our audiences. And if they push out of that, then it's very reasonable for you to come back and say, well, that's fine, but this is not under our original assumption. So something has changed and our pricing might change with that.
Exactly. And there are people who move the target. You know, at first it's this, and then 2 weeks later when we're entering storyboards, the target has moved. And again, we go back to this. Well, our job isn't actually to just do whatever you want us to do. Our job is to do this thing that we agreed 2 weeks ago. And here's what we agreed to.
Do you actually have them sign it?
We don't do a signing because I feel like that's a little petty. But we will send it to someone and say, this is the creative brief. Do you agree? Mm-hmm. And they will say, yeah, that looks great. And that's enough. I mean, if you really do get to the point where you're printing emails and saying, hey, you said this looks great. You've lost the, I mean, you're done.
We do make, not for videos because that's not as big of a project, but when we do like a website, we will have a document that says, you know, I agree this looks good. And it's not so much that we're getting them on record. It's that we're making them actually think about it.
Yep.
Because you can send them an email like, yeah, looks great. But if you send something like, sign this document and be responsible for making a decision, then they actually go back and they're like, okay, just one more change and then I'll sign it. And they focus on it. So it's a good tool in getting to do that. But you're right, there's always a fine line between, you know, being sort of petty and...
legalistic, you know, that sort of...
Well, I got this from my days doing business development. And that was actually rather than just, if it's an important document like that, where you potentially, maybe there are personal opinions or there are objections that you could anticipate, or this needs to be a rock solid foundation for our assumptions to move forward on the project, to actually go through it with stakeholders.
Yeah.
It is an extra investment in time, but I've found it really... One, you're reading through it with them,
yep.
Which I know that feels a little patronizing, but it's pretty important. But it also uncovers things right at the right time, right? Like a week later might be too late.
Yeah.
Like now is when you want to adjust it. It might be, we get this all the time, like, oh yeah, we forgot to involve this department and it's the development department and everything we've been talking about is fundraising, but we never involved them for whatever reasons. Yeah. We just had this come up. Oh yeah, there's the Canadian department. This could be in French, right? That doesn't change anything. Whoa, hold on. So it's important if you have these documents that are kind of foundation building documents, it's important, I think, to maybe sketch out a little bit of time and actually go through those with your clients.
And the thing that, I don't want to say it's the thing that ticks me off the most in life, but it's close. It's something that really gets me are client points of contact that refuse to let us talk to the people who actually make the decisions.
Oh, yeah.
And I get that it's a delicate balancing act, right? You don't want your VP of whatever to have to spend so much time in a storyboard review. But if that person is then going to look at the storyboard and review it and redline it and draw on it and everything, wouldn't it have been good for us to actually get their input before? It drives me nuts that you end up going another couple of rounds of sort of, oh, well, this guy doesn't like it. Like, right, but I've never heard from that guy. I don't understand.
That's a great conundrum because, you know, if I am the, I'm just someone who works in the communications department, and this project has been dropped on my desk, and I'm in charge of delivering the video, but my boss has to review it and my boss's boss has to review it. Like, how do you help them navigate those waters? Because they're in a position where they, you know, oftentimes, you know, their boss says, you know, something stupid and they have to be like, well, my boss said that and I have no recourse.
Right. Right. So I wish I had a better answer to this. And actually, that reminds me, I really should go and talk to the people who've done this really well. I feel like there's a special place in paradise for the people who do this really, really well. And you've worked with them and they're awesome. But I should go figure out how they do it. Because the most I can say to answer that is that at every stage I will ask, and who else needs to look at this? And what do you think they're going to say?
A lot of times I offer myself up as the fall guy. So, you know, my client tells their boss, well, you know, I told Hemming that, you know, we really want to do this and he's absolutely refusing and I don't know what to do. And so I go and I have the uncomfortable conversation and then hopefully can convince him and then take the heat off of my client who isn't in a position of authority and has more to lose than I do by, you know, pissing somebody off.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea and it forces you to be in contact with that decision maker as opposed to keeping it in the intermediary phase. There's this very strange dance of when more senior people get involved, and I don't know, I think it's interesting.
So coming up with the idea is always the most important part, I think, in terms of conceiving of something that's going to be effective. So do you have brainstorming sessions? Are there processes by which you go about this, or is it really just it's a work of art and it's, you know, it's you can't really define how it happens, but sometimes someone has an inspiration and sometimes, you know, you struggle. And
if it is that, please define how it happens.
No, I don't have a process. I don't think we do. I think every creative organization has at least a person, hopefully multiple people, who just is really quick. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they're more creative. It's not that they have better ideas. It's that they have ideas quickly that you can then iterate on. I mean, on a perfectly blank slate, I wouldn't say we have a process. I think we have a really good process once an idea has been put out there. And in our team, that's me. I'm the first draft person, you know, just in the conversation with the client. I'm usually
the language from the website and what you heard in the meeting. And
right. I mean, usually in the meeting,
an analogy,
I've pictured what this thing will be.
Yeah.
And I try not to pitch it because very often it's not the best idea, but it's the first idea. And once there's a first idea, now you have something to critique. So yeah, I will usually write out, and because I'm a very word focused person, I'll actually write it out as opposed to draw it, and then throw it to the team, and then we get into drawings and ideas. And very often, the sort of core nugget of my idea will stay, but so many details will change as a result of it mm-hmm. becoming a sort of team thing. But I wish I understood that process better. I understand the process of script writing. I understand the process of making the video, the client management, invoicing, sort of all the operational side. But the, how did we come up with that metaphor? Just happens. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Never just make up bullshit about your process.
I should. And I know a lot of firms will have like a, they'll have a name for it.
Website.
You
ever see the document that walks through the process for coming up with the new Pepsi logo?
No.
Hilarious.
Is it?
It's about like gravitational fields and subliminal messages.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some marketing firm put this together.
Well, it's basically what we did, right? I mean, we had the name, and then we sort of assigned the meaning to the name.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was very much happened backwards. And I think that's true with a lot of things.
Except if you read this document, it looks like it came out of, like, a conspiracy theorist camp. Like, it isn't, it's hard to believe a professional firm produced it. It's yours are based in a realm of reality that I think clients can connect with.
That. Well, I would love for you to send me that if you
gotta look it up. Yeah. It's hilarious. I'm not even joking. It's like there's whole graphs and like several pages about how gravity is involved.
That's not surprising. Although a client of ours recently, they were lucky enough to do this particular project was branded by IDEO, the amazing San Francisco firm, design thinking firm, and this brand guide is a work of art. I mean, it's incredible. I'm always annoyed that there are these firms that are just clearly better than everyone else. And then you see this work. And honestly, it was a brand guide for a small initiative for a not terribly large nonprofit. So it can't have been like the biggest work they've ever done. It was probably some junior designer there, but it's incredibly cool. And it's probably just because they're in that environment that expects that level of quality.
Maybe they have a cool template that they...
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Pull out the $25,000 logo template for these guys.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's only 45 pages. Yeah. And then we saw a proposal. I don't know where it was. I think it was published somewhere publicly, but we passed it around the co-working space. It was a pentagram. You know Pentagram, the sort of super hoity-toity design firm? It's not worth going into, but they're like IDEO, but they're much more sort of personality based. So there are these, it started with five really amazing designers, like world renowned designers. And they basically formed this cooperative. Anyway, so we saw a proposal of theirs that was passed around sort of like, this is how the big shots do proposals. And it was just, again, it's just a beautiful thing. I mean, I think, I don't know. I really like it when the simple things like your email signature or whatever, or your proposals are beautiful.
I'm so curious to see these. It also, though, just screams that I don't know half of nonprofits pay attention to any of that. Like, I feel like some of it is performance for ourselves.
We have that argument all the time.
You just, like, look at the emails they send, and they're clearly sending from, like, Microsoft Outlook 1998 or something, some version nobody's ever heard of.
Or honestly, there's a price aversion, right? Like, there are things that look luxury.
Yeah.
That are inappropriate for that audience.
Well, this is actually, my partner works in kind of like digital marketing and strategy space, and it's actually something conscious that, I don't think rightfully so, but something that's in the minds of communications directors that if they're supposed to be a very frugal organization, that if they send something out and it looks very well produced, then that means the funds were, you know, spent yeah. on glamour and polish and that not makes on sense. Program work.
Yeah.
And so they'll actually like take stuff and put it into Word and just like use Word's default template to make it kind of look like it was put together by an intern.
Interesting.
And it's funny the kind of politicking people will do.
I'm not surprised by that.
I appreciate though the same thing, like a good email signature, nice template, good white space.
Yeah, I think we've become really spoiled by good design. There was something in the last Harvard Business Review about if everyone does design thinking, is it still a differentiator? Yeah. And I think that's very
spoiled
true.
Spoiled by good design. I like that.
I think so. I mean, I have a personal, on the personal side, I have a financial advisor who is great, but will only send printout things. And I'm used to using mint.com and using these really great online tools. And it's annoying enough that even though he's a good financial advisor, I routinely examine whether or not I want to continue with the relationship because it's aesthetically just an unpleasant experience. Yeah.
If you ever do leave, you have to tell him because he will tell his friends
yeah.
that story. Oh, he left me because he didn't like my printouts.
Yeah, right? I mean, well, it's the whole experience. It's, yeah. I got something in the mail. And, you know, I'm sort of a typical millennial in that way where it's like, oh, I got something in the mail. Oh, well, come on.
I actually had to temper my own distaste for that because I've been enjoying French food. I'm on a French kick. And every French restaurant's website, I think, is intentionally vomit-inducing. Like, they're just
restaurant websites in bad.
Not
in
just restaurant websites, French restaurant. Okay. Like, I think it might be a thing, mm. like an aesthetic, that they maybe going
French
back
country style websites.
Yeah, maybe going back to the communications
lots of ducks.
Director yeah. who thinks chickens. Everything needs to be in Word. Maybe they're like, we have to make it look like all the money was spent on the food. But they're just so bad. It doesn't matter. Unless you get into the really fancy ones, all of them, mm-hmm. they look like they're not even WordPress. They're not Drupal. There's some e-commerce system yeah. offered by like onehosting.com for $2.99 a month. Like they're all really bad.
So someone comes to you. We talked about kind of when you would want a video and the fact that it should be part of a larger marketing strategy and sort of the politics of getting that initial process up and running. But then once you've got a script, once you've got approved art, do they take, is it basically handed over to you then? Like then it's basically you guys sit down and you do the real work of putting it all together?
Yeah, so very loosely, we have an 8-week process. The first month is, or the first 4 weeks is pre-production, and the last 4 weeks is obviously production. Pre-production is broken up into script and art direction for the first 2 weeks. So we put together a creative brief with all the audience stuff and what characters might look like, and if there's a dog, what the dog will look like, and you know all that sort of basic what this thing will look like, and a script. And we go back and forth a few times, and then that's finalized. And then we do a storyboard, which is sort of, I mean, you know this, but for the sake of other people, it's sort of like a comic book version of a video. We do, again, a couple rounds of that. That gets approved. And in the last 4 weeks is three drafts of the video. That's our standard process.
And what percentage of the effort is that pre-production? It's half the time, but is it half the effort for you guys?
It's about a third. So our average project is about 120 hours of work, roughly. And about 40 is in that pre-production. It's in script writing, art direction, and storyboarding. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because there's more time spent in revision and meetings and talking, which inherently has these email lags of a day or two.
How long are these videos?
Typically 2 minutes is sort of our norm.
Is that a benchmark, 2 minutes? I mean, I've heard 2 minutes before.
It's a number. People will it's a common question is like, how long should a video be? And unfortunately, the answer is it depends. But I think a couple of things. The most important for me is viewing context. So if it's a video at an event right before a keynote presentation, it could be as long as you want. Your audience is in a chair. They're paying attention. Mm-hmm. It would be rude for them to do something else. You know, it can be 20 minutes. It shouldn't be, but it could be. If it's a Facebook video or a YouTube pre-roll ad, it should be 15 seconds. It should be 20 seconds. I mean, people aren't going to stomach more. Or if it is longer, the beginning needs to be really cool to get you to actually pay attention. Mm-hmm. And if it's Facebook, it needs to work without sound. So it really depends on where the video is going to be. I think if it's a video on your homepage, which is probably our most typical use case, 90 seconds is a really good number.
There's a really great report that the New York Times put out, probably, it might even be dated now, because I bet it was about 2 years ago, where they analyzed all the videos on their website, and they came up with a bunch of metrics. And, you know, the sort of the biggest message was 2 minutes was, like, the benchmark,
yeah. Really,
in terms of, like, viewership dropping off and things. But it's fascinating, and it's, you know, they were really dissected, like, you know, what percentage of the people drop off here, and then if they make it, you know, to this point in the video, then they're very likely to make it to the end. I included the metrics in a lot of my presentations for about a year when I was arguing with people about how the videos were too long.
I bet it parallels reading habits for article length. Probably the same percentage of people that'll sit there and watch a 45-minute video are going to read the 13-page New York Times article. Actually, more people probably read because...
45-minute video is a very big commitment.
Yeah. It's at your own pace, though. Video, yeah. There's something that's different about trying to return to a video where you left off.
You're locked in. I mean, yeah. You basically need to watch the whole thing. And I think most people's lives are not structured in a way that they can just say, yeah, I'm going to sit here and not get interrupted for 45 minutes.
And you don't get to control the pacing.
Right.
I'll see an article and be like, you know what, I don't really care about this little side page or side section that talks about, you know, the author's trip to Nepal for 3 pages.
That's actually my number one objection to video is the inability to skim. My number two is that it requires headphones, which I don't usually have on. Which means that I then have to plug headphones in, especially with all these open office environments where you're sitting at work and you're like,
actually,
how do I watch a video?
You were talking about video not needing sound. I watched one from the creator of Mario, what's his name? Miyazaki, I think. Morimoto, sorry.
Yes.
Right? I don't know. Someone's going to... Well, this will be our first email. Someone will correct us on who the creator of Mario is. But it's cute because I had the same thing.
We've been talking for an hour. I don't know who's going to be listening.
I didn't have the audio, but it was questions, and they had the text on the screen, and he just shook his head yes or no, up or down, or like shrugged. And so it actually...
That's really awesome.
Yeah.
And I actually think we as video producers should think more about how we can make it so that you can watch it on mute. And not even say it, just add that.
Is that like does your logo look good in black and white?
Exactly.
Is your video good on mute?
Exactly. Or does your website look good on a phone? You know, although that's probably more essential than anything else.
I like it. Let's add that.
That sounds like extra work. That's like you've already gone through the budget, and now you have to go back and revise the animation because you have to explain this one thing visually that, you know, if you don't have the audio for context.
Yeah.
I think it actually is a brilliant idea.
If we have responsive design for mobile, what could we call it for?
Well, the other
designing without sound.
You also have to do the opposite. Then you also have to do just for people who are listening and they have got their phone in their pocket,
right? Which is pretty common.
Like if you're listening to Pandora and the ad comes on or something, and you can't watch it.
Bam.
Or you see people who watch TV on the bus, like they have a phone and they're watching a TV episode. And then, of course, you know, someone comes and jostles them, and they're not watching that part. Like, clearly...
I'm just waiting for the new iPad, though, that giant... Like, people are going to be walking around with this
thing. And taking photos with it?
Oh, yeah. it's like 13 inches. It's basically like you unhinge the screen from your MacBook.
But you know they will.
Yeah, oh, yeah. But people are going to be watching that on the bus, too.
Yeah, it's going to be
good. Which now it's on your phone. It's semi-private. Mm-hmm. but now someone's going to be holding a 13-inch. They're basically carrying. You're carrying around flat screen TVs.
Yeah.
Connect Wi-Fi.
I don't think people are going to buy them, but I mean that's a separate conversation.
So so you delivered the video. Everybody's happy. And then what happens? Then you send them.
In way too many cases, that's it. In way too many cases, that's it. And I am amazed at the number of people who come back because that was a good experience. I mean, for me, the thing I really, really want to do more of is pay attention to what happens afterwards. Who's watching it? Is it driving conversion? Is it successful based on the metrics that we established earlier? But
I can't tell you how many times that's happened to where you've there's been a big organizational commitment. They've spent $10,000, a lot of hours internally. Mm-hmm. The video gets done. Everybody's sort of sick of it at this point. And so some junior staff member puts it, on the three levels deep in your website, and then it's forgotten about.
Yeah. But everyone's happy.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
I think it's a lot of it really is fatigue. It's gosh, we've been working on this, and there's this release that it's done.
Yeah.
We completed this project. I mean, the reason you're doing it is that's just the beginning of, theoretically, it's the beginning of the campaign.
Right. And that's something I have a few goals for this next year, sort of starting a few months ago. I don't know why I started doing goal stuff then.
Have you written down goals?
Yeah. And one of them is...
Do you have a coach that's helping you to develop these things?
No, but I suppose I could find one.
Yeah.
one of the goals is to do that. Is to ignore whether people will pay us to do it. I just want to start including it by default, that we are going to do post-launch surveillance and we are going to do post-launch recommendations.
You should charge them more if they don't.
I think that's a good idea. It's like we charge more if they don't let us use it for promotional purposes.
You should charge more in general and give a discount if they promote back to your original rights. That would be it.
Yeah. I talked to a guy a couple years ago who by default includes $10,000 of ad placement for all his videos. It's in every proposal. And it's just like, this is how much a video costs.
Yeah.
And it's in there as a line item. And if someone really reads it, they'll cut it.
That's how the ad agencies actually make their money, which sort of starts to make sense in that context, which is like, well, if they've got a vested interest in making sure people see it, then people are more likely to see it.
Right, because your client's going to be way happier. Oh, 500,000 people watched the video. That's really cool. It drove this much traffic. That's really cool.
All Indian spam bots.
I don't know. I mean, I think that, there's, again, that myth of you put it on YouTube and people will watch it. Like, they won't. There's just so much stuff.
Well, I mean, that's also...
If you promote it, people will watch it.
It's also defining your audience. It's like, views are such a vanity metric. You're usually... You've got something, right?
Yeah.
Whether you're trying to test knowledge retention, you're trying to get them to go register at a website for a new Social Security benefit or something.
Right.
And unfortunately, usually that's cross-departmental, so there's not always the connection there where you can actually see where the rubber kind of meets the road and the tangible results of the video. It's cool though that you set up the Google Alerts. How else do you kind of track your baby after it gets sent out?
I mean, that's about it. I don't know how helpful it is. Honestly, it feels pretty overwhelming because I get a lot on a daily basis.
Have you ever you put out 160 videos? You said
roughly, yeah.
You ever come across one in the wild?
Other than the taxi one, no.
But did that actually happen? So you jumped in
The gap? I mean, it was everywhere. It was everywhere for while. In, I think, 14 or 15 markets. I mean, it was in all of the cabs that they... Because they make a payment thing. They make one of the things that has the screen and you slide the card in. And so they just made it... That was the ad that was on there. So, like, for a while, it was every cab you got into. It's like, oh, there's my friend Chris, who volunteered as an actor. Thank you, Chris.
So, despite all this frustration, what is you still enjoying the work?
Very, very much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're glad that you took the leap and got out of the 9-to-5 job working for the man?
Yeah, although what's cool is that, and you probably know this, is that success is feeling like it's a 9-to-5 job again, right? Like, there's all this time where it's a struggle, an entrepreneur, and, you know, business owner. But honestly, at this point, it's a job. It's like I show up, things basically function. I provide value. I go home. I mean, it's a job.
You can also say no to a project.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
Client.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. We don't, but we could.
So what is the hardest part then? Is it regulating? I guess you're five people now. You're looking to hire one more person. Is it actually, I guess, regulating that productivity? Like, if you're down a person, that's a significant chunk of your
staff. So I spent an hour and a half today staring at a calendar of the next 6 weeks because I am gone for a week in October. The new animator that I mentioned, Hannah, she's getting married, so she's gone for a week, which is great for her.
She's gonna bring her laptop on.
Exactly. Well, her honeymoon is later, another week, but I'm not worried about that right now.
God damn it.
Yeah.
Employees.
Well, I'm just really glad it's not all not just 2 weeks in a row. And then Dave, my business partner, is also gone. He's gone for a conference for a week, and then he's gone for another wedding for another week. So I'm pretty worried about that. But I wouldn't say that's hard. That's just worrying. I think the hardest thing is finding good people that are better. Like, I don't want to hire anyone that produces work that is worse than the work we already produce, which means that most people applying won't qualify. I mean, I don't think we're the world's best or anything, but I think we're probably in the 85th percentile in terms of quality.
It's oddly specific.
I think about it a lot. and my big mission for the next year or so is to get us into like the 90th. I make a point of trying to meet with people who would never hire us because we're just not good enough.
What's going to take you that extra 5%?
So I think knowing what we need to accomplish, paying more attention to what's current and what's really cool and being inspired by cutting edge techniques is useful. One thing I think is taking time away from client work to do totally independent spec work, show work, which we're currently in the planning stages for being able to do over the winter.
Plan that out, huh? Like,
yeah.
You set aside, like, you budget it as if it was a project.
If we don't, we won't do it. And if we ask people to do it in their home time or in their off time, it doesn't get the same level of love.
Mm-hmm.
I was just in London last week, and I met with the director of content for RGA London. RGA is the ad firm that does Beats by Dre and Apple and Google. I mean, they're a big firm. And I asked him, like, okay, where are we in terms of would you hire us for one of your major clients? And he said, well, no. But your work is okay. It just, there's no wow. And so one of my big missions for the next 6 months is to create something that's wow. So the big challenge is to sort of go up market another step. So right now we're doing big nonprofits associations, which is awesome, and we want to keep doing it. But to get to like global brands, I think we need another step.
Gotta go corporate,
I guess.
So you're a nonprofit largely because that's kind of the market in DC.
It's the market in DC. It's the language I speak. You know, so much about it is, I think, sort of culture vocabulary. We do a lot of work in the international development sector. And I think, you know, World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, a lot of big development firms. And I think the reason that we do that is because I'm an international development kid. I grew up doing that. You know,
that an idea for
such a fucking frustrating market.
Hey, but it's not for me, because that's my dad, and that's my family. Like,
well,
all of them
are
in that
sector. Like
that,
you know, the beauty of that work is the on the ground like assistance you're providing. You know, being that person in Africa, working on the project is greatly satisfying. Dealing with the project managers that are in Washington D.C. and the bureaucracy involved in USAID and the World Bank.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
So I can totally hear you, and I know a number of firms that refuse.
Yeah.
In fact, I mean, I've had conversations with the owners of a number of really big digital firms who won't do World Bank work. But for me, it really, like, I get it.
Yeah.
I've lived that existence to some degree. I mean, not myself, but it's like everybody in my family's in the development world. So for me, it's easy. So what I'm trying to learn is the vocabulary of big advertising and corporate marketing. And it's actually been really difficult. So I'm sort of lucky in that I can easily do big nonprofit and association and international development, which is our core.
So you're very goal-oriented. Do you have a five-year plan?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it very, you know, we were redoing our website, we just sit around bullshitting about it every once in a while, and we're starting to take it seriously. But one of the things that we were talking about the other day was like sort of, you know, the having a mission statement, which is a very grand, aspirational kind of statement, which is not like, we're going to make good videos for great clients. It's we're going to be the best, or we're going to be $100 million, or we're going to, I mean, something that's like, you know, I remember Sony's like a great example. Like they're famously, their mission statement was to be like the biggest electronics company in the world.
Right.
They became that. So what's yours?
We want to be, I mean, it's very modest, but I mean, we want to be the best animation and motion graphics firm in the region, certainly.
The Nova region, the Potomac region?
The Mid-Atlantic region.
the Columbia Heights region.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Maybe we can accomplish DuPont Circle.
There's actually this grocery store in Japan that their mission is to have 100% market penetration within 500 meters.
Okay.
And I was like, that's oddly
specific.
What does
that even mean?
So if you are going to purchase an item that they carry and you live within 500 meters of their store, they want 100% of the time for you to come to their store.
That's doable.
Yeah. And they stock like 32,000 items. If you ask, you're like, I really want blue chopsticks. And I'm like, we don't have them. They will stock them from that day forward.
Huh.
So it's all about serving this hyper-targeted audience.
That's really cool.
But it's funny, though. You could actually say, like, I want to be the best within 50 meters of wherever I am. Because you don't have an office. So
right.
You're in DuPont, you're in D.C., you're in wherever you want to be.
Yeah. And then I think, I mean, we want to be globally in the top 20. I mean, that's about it. I mean, it's not, we don't need to be the best. We won't be the best. Because once you get into that sort of realm of, yeah, we do big global brand stuff. You can't possibly capture all of it because the diversity of styles and approaches is just going to happen. But we'd like to enter that sort of range.
Well, we have our one kind of tradition here that we've come up with so far, unless you have suggestions for others because we're looking for hooks.
I like this tradition, though.
Yeah. We ask people to give a shout-out to a nonprofit that they think needs a little attention or deserves some attention. Is there somebody you've worked with or someone you've given money to or someone that's been on your radar recently is particularly worthy of letting people know about?
We haven't worked with them. I'd love to work with them. But the Electronic Frontier Foundation for me is fighting a very, very important fight, which is keeping our data secure, our data practices as a country and as companies and as a race, as human race, consistent with privacy, human rights protections, non-exploitation, and I rarely give money in general, but I never hesitate to give money to them, so I suppose I would say them.
That's great. I'm surprised nobody's suggesting them. A lot of techies. It's a great organization.
Yeah.
Okay.
GetLeft.org.
That's right.
Sometimes we gotta be like, go Google that.
Yeah,
find that
it is EFF.org. And you can, if you want, you can go on Amazon. You can sign up for a program called Amazon Smile, where they give, I think, 1% of all your purchase price to a nonprofit. And you can designate any number of nonprofits, and it just, and then there's a Chrome extension called Always Smile that will just redirect all your Amazon traffic to smile.amazon, and you're automatically donating to whatever nonprofit.
Don't you think that's crap, though, that you have to remember every time you go to Amazon to opt in?
You just put the Chrome extension on.
I know. You should just be able to set a default, like every purchase.
That is setting a default. You install the Chrome extension.
Yeah, but that's on Amazon. That's you. That's you getting an extension to remind you to do something.
And yeah, but I think it's pretty cool that they do it at all.
That's cool.
Especially because they're not really profitable anyway.
Like, can they write it off, though? Is it a tax deduction?
Yeah, probably.
There's some rub to this.
Probably, but great.
Oh, yeah, and nonprofits, if you didn't know, you need to go and collect that money. So if you're somebody listening right now,
they don't send you a check. You actually have to go.
Yeah,
do you really?
Yeah, so it's going to be some minimum, and you have to go set up your account, but they like hold it for you.
Well, then they probably do it just like they do their affiliate program.
Yeah, it's probably Amazon's like getting a loan from all these nonprofits that haven't gone and checked their account. Mm. So go there, smile.amazon.com. See if you got any money waiting
for
you.
Well, cheers. Thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoy yourself.
Yeah, cheers.